Good morning, everyone. Thank you for being here. If everyone could just grab their seats, we're going to get this panel started. Welcome, or a continued welcome, to the Federalist Society's 7th Annual Executive Branch Review Conference. Our topic at this panel this morning is how the federal government litigates cases. Having left the Justice Department 5 days ago, have a pretty fresh take on that subject, having spent about 2.5 years overseeing a large swath of that litigation. So I thought, to kick off our conversation today, I would offer two themes born out of my own experience there, and then introduce our panelists and kick the conversation over to them. First, there is the question of the federal government changing legal positions in particular cases, an issue that most often arises when the federal government is the defendant, and one that typically generates much public debate. Now, I want to put this in some perspective. The overwhelming majority of defensive litigation handled by the Department of Justice is comprised of day-to-day cases of limited national significance. For example, if a national park employee in Alaska brings a wrongful termination claim, or a patient at a federally funded health clinic in St. Louis loses a kidney and brings a medical malpractice claim, DOJ defends the United States. That work and the federal government's litigation positions and legal views remain basically the same over time, regardless of the administration in power. Accordingly, these cases don't often capture the headlines and usually are not the subject of expert panels like this one. Though the private party, federal agency, DOJ, and judicial incentives created by the existence of a limitless judgment fund probably is a topic worthy of more attention than it gets. In any event, other litigation at DOJ is very high profile. For example, defending an agency's marquee regulatory program from an APA challenge, or defending presidential action. Elections, changes in administration can have a significant effect on these marquee cases. The most notable cases are those in which DOJ has simply come to a new legal judgment, requiring a frank reversal in position. There were a few of those in 2017, such as the Murphy Oil case about the enforceability of class waivers under the Federal Arbitration Act. But perhaps even more tricky are the litigation postures that arise in the first months of a new administration, as agencies shift, sometimes dramatically, from one policy choice to another. A common situation we faced in 2017 was as follows. The Obama administration had promulgated a regulation on an important or high-profile issue. A party sued, claiming the regulation is unlawful in some respect. The litigation remained pending in district court or appellate court, often with the regulation enjoined or stayed in some respect. Under the Trump administration, the agency sought litigation stays to permit regulatory change, while the plaintiffs pressed to lock in legal victories. We saw this situation in many areas. One example is the APA's Waters of the United States rule. The challenge in such situations is that the federal government, now contemplating regulatory change, does not want to say too much in defense of the old rule, because such arguments might undermine the coming defense of any new rule. At the same time, the federal government doesn't want to say too much in derogation of the current rule, both because of DOJ's general duty to defend existing law, but also because the federal government wants to avoid later APA claims that it had prejudged any issues while it was considering a new rule. Presidential transitions can always result in these difficult litigation postures, but the increasing prevalence of the nationwide injunction has exacerbated the issue. Perhaps our panelists will have more to say about that topic in a few minutes. The second theme I think is important to today's topic concerns the federal government's general practices in affirmative litigation. Here, if you indulge me for a moment, I want to harken back to some founding era thought. James Madison famously lamenting in Federalist 51 that men are not angels and thus need a government, explained, "In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and you next oblige it to control itself." Our government is adept at creating rules to control the government, but it sometimes fails to control itself. This is as true for the Department of Justice as it is for any other governmental agency or organ. Over the last 2 years, several of the policies announced by DOJ were part of an effort to force the agency to, as Madison said, control itself. Examples include the memorandum issued by Attorney General Sessions barring inclusion of third-party payments and settlements, and the memorandum issued by Associate Attorney General Brand barring certain uses of sub-regulatory guidance documents in affirmative litigation. The latter memo was an attempt to rein in the use of what some commentators call regulatory dark matter. A third example, and a very significant one, is the memorandum Attorney General Sessions signed on his last day in office, Principles and Procedures for Civil Consent Decrees and Settlement Agreements with State and Local Governments. The consent decree is another practice in the regulatory cosmos, but one that is even less visible than the dark matter of guidance documents. A consent decree is a binding court judgment, and it can serve an important function in a range of cases and enforcement areas. But some consent decrees are voluminous in their requirements and have virtually perpetual life. The Antitrust Division, for example, started an effort over the last 2 years to dissolve ancient but still operative consent decrees, and it found some noteworthy targets. There was, for example, a decree still in existence from 1914 concerning rubber hoof pads for horseshoes. Another one from 1921 related to music rolls for piano players, for player pianos. And yet another, my personal favorite, controlled the market for horse buggy whips. The continued existence of these old decrees is not what you would call careful regulatory action or good government. This is ancient cosmic junk unnecessarily floating around the regulatory atmosphere. Consent decrees are, in effect, a set of regulations for a single party, overseen by the Department of Justice, a federal judge, and quite often a private party monitor appointed by the court. In practice, consent decrees can result in one or all of these entities directing the day-to-day operations of a business or a local or state government agency for years on end. As should be obvious from the description, such a regime can be as intrusive as, if not more intrusive than, a comprehensive set of regulations. Take, for example, the consent decree that now governs the Chicago Police Department, a decree that DOJ objected to in a filing last year, but one that is similar in substance to many that DOJ agreed to in years past. Regarding the Chicago decree, DOJ noted the decree is a 226-page document governing virtually every facet of CPD operations in excruciating detail. The decree's 799 paragraphs and hundreds more subparagraphs cover community policing, impartial policing, crisis intervention, use of force, recruitment, hiring, promotion, training, supervision, officer wellness and support, accountability, transparency, and data collection. That is regulation of a local government agency. And so Attorney General Sessions' memo noted that while consent decrees are sometimes necessary and appropriate to secure compliance with federal law, federal court decrees that impose wide-ranging and long-term obligations on state or local governments are extraordinary remedies that raise sensitive federalism concerns. And the memo set out to place some controls in the department, both in the approval process and the substance. One of the most important limits being that a consent decree must not be used to achieve general policy goals or to extract greater or different relief from the defendant than could be obtained through agency enforcement authority or by litigating the matter to judgment. Imposing conditions that could not be obtained through litigation to judgment is similar to creating regulations beyond the bounds of law. And just because a court imposes such a decree does not make it appropriate or wise. Courts, like executive branch agencies, can exceed their powers and distort constitutional norms. There's much more to be said about this topic, but for now I'll leave it there in the hope that it generates some discussion among the panelists. And so let's turn to our panel. We are very fortunate to have a distinguished group joining us this morning. They each merit a 5-minute introduction, but I will provide only brief biographies so that they can get to the substance of their remarks. Our first speaker this morning is Gene Scher. Mr. Scher is a partner at Scher Jaffe LLP, where he specializes in civil appeals. He has argued a broad range of cases in the U.S. Supreme Court, every federal circuit, numerous federal district courts, and state appellate courts. From 2005 until 2014, Mr. Scher was the chair of the nationwide appellate practice at Winston & Strawn. He teaches as an adjunct professor at the Brigham Young University Law School. He clerked at the Supreme Court for Chief Justice Berger and Justice Scalia, and at the D.C. Circuit for then-Judge Starr. He is a graduate of Yale Law School. Our next speaker will be Scott Keller. Mr. Keller is chair of Baker Botts' Supreme Court and constitutional law practice. He is the former Solicitor General of Texas, and he has argued numerous cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. Mr. Keller also served as Senator Ted Cruz's chief counsel on the Senate Judiciary Committee. He clerked for Justice Kennedy and Judge Kaczynski and was a Bristow Fellow in the Office of the Solicitor General of the United States. He is a graduate of the University of Texas School of Law. After Mr. Keller, we'll hear from Neil Eggleston. Mr. Eggleston is a litigation partner in the Washington, D.C. office of Kirkland & Ellis, LLP. He has a distinguished record of public service, having held a number of senior government roles. Most recently, from 2014 through 2017, Mr. Eggleston was White House counsel to President Obama. Earlier in his career, Mr. Eggleston served as associate counsel to President Clinton, as the deputy chief counsel to the U.S. House of Representatives Select Committee investigating the Iran-Contra affair, and as assistant U.S. attorney and chief appellate attorney for the Southern District of New York. He also clerked at the Supreme Court for Chief Justice Berger and at the Third Circuit for Judge Hunter. Mr. Eggleston is a graduate of Northwestern Law School. And our final panelist will be Paul Clement. Mr. Clement is a partner also at the Washington, D.C. office of Kirkland & Ellis, LLP, where he specializes in high-stakes appeals and strategic counseling. He served as Solicitor General of the United States from 2005 through 2008, and as Acting Solicitor General for an additional year before that. Mr. Clement has argued nearly 100 cases before the Supreme Court, including 30 times in just the last five terms. Mr. Clement is a distinguished lecturer in law at the Georgetown University Law Center and a distinguished lecturer in government at Georgetown University. He clerked at the Supreme Court for Justice Scalia and at the D.C. Circuit for Judge Silberman. Mr. Clement is a graduate of Harvard Law School. Thanks to each of these distinguished lawyers for joining us today. Mr. Scher, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Jesse, for your kind introduction and for your excellent comments. It's a pleasure to be with all of you today. Early in my career, I had the privilege of working closely with someone that some of you may still remember as I look around the room. He was a man named Rex Lee, who was the father of Senator Mike Lee from Utah. Now, he had been a professor and the first dean at the BYU Law School, where I now teach part-time. And as a law professor and dean, he had been a very vocal economic and social conservative. For example, he wrote a book in the 1970s that was widely credited with helping to defeat the Equal Rights Amendment. And when Ronald Reagan became president in 1981, Rex was selected as his first Solicitor General. And he took a lot of heat at the time for a lot of the things that he had written as a law professor and as a lawyer prior to that. So it was a bit surprising to many of his fellow conservatives when, as the Solicitor General, he politely declined to try to find an abortion case in which he could urge the Supreme Court to overrule Roe versus Wade, which he viewed as a judicial abomination. But nevertheless, he was not anxious to bring that kind of a case to the court. And His reasoning was simple. He knew the court quite well, having clerked for Justice White and having litigated a few cases there after his clerkship, and he knew the court was not ready to overrule Roe. And so to those who said he should still take a swing at Roe and at least educate the justices on why it was wrong, he replied, "Well, I'm the Solicitor General, not the pamphleteer general." And unfortunately, or fortunately, his successor took a different approach, and that decision brought us Planned Parenthood versus Casey. And whatever one thinks of abortion as a matter of policy, or whatever one thinks of Roe versus Wade, the Casey decision was, I think it's fair to say, a significant blow to both federalism and the separation of powers, which are the twin subjects of the practice group that is sponsoring our presentation today. So, the temptation to be a pamphleteer rather than a serious lawyer seems to be an occupational hazard for government lawyers, regardless of party affiliation. You may recall, for example, that late in the prior administration, lawyers in the Justice Department Civil Rights Division teamed up with some political appointees in the Education Department to require schools around the country under the banner of Title VII to let students who identify as members of the opposite sex use the bathrooms assigned to the opposite sex. And that was despite very clear language in Title VII itself that allows schools and any institutions covered by Title IX to have separate bathrooms for the two biological sexes. But in a case known as GG versus Gloucester County, two Democratic appointees to the Fourth Circuit sustained the Education Department's interpretation under the soon-to-be-buried Auer deference doctrine. And I and a now confirmed Fifth Circuit judge were hired to represent the school board in that case, and not too surprisingly, we were able to get the Supreme Court to stay the Fourth Circuit's decision and then to grant certiorari on both the Auer deference issue and the substantive Title IX question in the case. And as luck would have it, the old administration was replaced by the current administration, and the new Education Department decided to follow the statute and revoke the prior bathroom guidance. Well, to me, Gloucester County is a classic example of a Justice Department and a left-leaning administration leaving the role of serious government lawyer and allowing itself to become a pamphleteer for a political cause. Did they really think they could persuade five justices to ignore the plain language of Title IX on a question as sensitive as bathrooms? Or did they even think they could persuade three justices to do that? And by the way, the Gloucester County case is also an example of the challenges and opportunities faced by a new administration in dealing with pamphleteering by its predecessors. When the new administration took office, merits briefing in the Gloucester County case was already well underway, and so the new Education Department and the Justice Department had to decide very quickly what they wanted to do about the case. And they made a wise choice. It was disappointing for someone who was hoping to argue another case at the Supreme Court, but they made the wise choice to moot the case and to save the fight over Auer deference for another day. Well, another example of government lawyers succumbing to the pamphleteering temptation was a case called EEOC versus Hosanna Tabor. A Supreme Court case involving the ministerial exemption to anti-discrimination laws. Now, certainly the government in that case could legitimately argue, albeit incorrectly, I think, but they could legitimately argue that the rights of a religious organization's employees to be free from discrimination trumped the organization's religious freedom rights. But the Solicitor General's office in that case went a big step further. It was apparently trying to establish the position that's popular in academic circles that the First Amendment's Free Exercise Clause extends no further than freedom to worship. It doesn't actually include exercising religion outside of the of worship spaces. So the Solicitor General's office argued not only that the religious organization there hadn't made a sufficient case for an exemption under the Free Exercise Clause, but the office argued that the Free Exercise Clause, quote, had nothing to do with the issue. Now, not surprisingly, Justice Scalia, when that argument was made at oral argument, bellowed, "That's remarkable." And surprisingly, Justice Kagan, who just a few months earlier had been the boss of the very people who were making that argument, agreed with Justice Scalia that the government's position was remarkable, and not surprisingly, the court squarely rejected that position by a vote of 9-0, thereby once again illustrating the cost of abandoning sound lawyering in favor of pamphleteering. Perhaps the most amusing example of this phenomenon is a case that I've been handling for the last several years on behalf of the North Carolina legislature, defending two North Carolina laws dealing with the rights of transgender persons in public bathrooms. This was another case in which the Civil Rights Division and the prior administration, joined by the ACLU, tried to impose its view of sound bathroom policy on recalcitrant state and local governments. Well, during a hearing in that case on a motion before a very genteel Southern Republican-appointed district judge, my friend Paul Smith, who successfully argued the Lawrence versus Texas case in the Supreme Court, was representing the ACLU at this hearing. And Paul took the very reasonable position that although he felt his client's right to use the bathroom of their choice trumped the state's interest in limiting access to women's bathrooms to biological women, the state, Paul acknowledged, at least had a legitimate interest in protecting women's bodily privacy. But the Justice Department lawyer who was at the hearing, apparently unable to resist the temptation to be a pamphleteer, took issue with Paul on that point. She thought that Paul was giving the state legislature too much credit. And she argued that, in fact, there is no legitimate state interest in separating the sexes in public bathrooms. And to illustrate, she pointed to the private school to which she sends her own children. And this school apparently boasts a kind of unisex throne room where children of both sexes gather to do whatever they need to do and just learn to embrace their bodily differences. And so she said, you know, my kid's private school does this and it works out just fine. Well, our traditional Southern judge just looked at her in disbelief, as though to say, wow, you Yankees have lost your senses to a greater degree than I had imagined. And not surprisingly, he ruled against her a few weeks later. Unfortunately, the new administration soon dropped the lawsuit and left it to the ACLU to continue it. Well, the moral of these two stories is twofold. First, if you're representing the government, I would urge you just to be a good lawyer and resist the temptation to be a pamphleteer for your administration's favorite political causes, however worthy they may be. But secondly, if you're opposing the government in litigation and your opponent can't seem to resist the temptation to be a pamphleteer, don't get in their way.
Thank you. Well, that's not working.
Thank you, Mr. Scheer. Mr. Keller, you're up.
Thank you. You know, I've heard a lot of various opposing counsel call their adversaries in litigation many different names, but pamphleteer, I think that's the first time. So I think we're going to add that to the lexicon here at today's Federalist Society Conference. Thank you very much for the invitation to be here and to my co-panelists. You know, in some ways, the fact that I'm on this panel, having been the Texas Solicitor General, may seem a bit odd in the sense that we're talking about how does the federal government litigate cases, and of course, I would not have had a direct seat at the table for those cases. But what I did have was a close vantage point from the other side. And today, in my brief remarks, I want to hit on three different points from that vantage point of seeing from the other side how the federal government litigates cases, and particularly from the state plaintiff side. First is just where this phenomenon of state plaintiff lawsuits come from. We all take it for granted now, but it wasn't always this way that there was a bevy of state plaintiff lawsuits. And related to that, then, my second and third points are going to be, particularly under the Trump administration, not only the quantity of state plaintiff lawsuits, but also the remedial nature, the nationwide injunction explosion that we've been seeing. So I'll start first with, where did all these state plaintiff lawsuits come from? Because obviously when a single state or a bunch of states band together as plaintiffs and they sue the federal government and they challenge a federal policy, the Department of Justice, the federal government, is going to be defending that lawsuit. And so you're in a posture where state AG's offices are litigating against DOJ. I've heard some people say that maybe this kicked off a little over a decade ago in Massachusetts versus EPA, where the Supreme Court recognized that states had, quote, special solicitude, unquote, in the standing analysis. And some have suggested that maybe that opened the courthouse doors in a way that hadn't existed before, in that states could get into court as plaintiffs under looser Article III standing doctrines. I'm not sure that's right. And since Massachusetts versus EPA, I'm not sure that there's actually been a case where a court has said a state has special solicitude, that's why they have standing, and the state would not have had it under ordinary or at least pre-existing standing principles. You know, the Fifth Circuit DAPA case that we litigated, the Deferred Action Program in the Obama era, the Fifth Circuit did recognize that states do have special solicitude in the standing analysis, but that was a third or fourth layered argument after going through just the ordinary concrete injury analysis. So I'm not sure that that's actually what is having the effect of all the new state plaintiff lawsuits. I actually think that it may very well be attributed to the development of state solicitor general offices. These offices have not been around for all that long. In the last few decades, many other states have created state Solicitor General offices. You know, Sixth Circuit Judge Jeff Sutton was the Ohio Solicitor General. You know, Greg Coleman in Texas, now Senator Cruz, Texas Solicitor Generals. But those offices are actually pretty recent. The Texas Solicitor General's office is celebrating its 20th anniversary this year. It's only been around for two decades. And the reason I bring that up is these offices are, of course, created for appellate expertise, for representation of the state in the U.S. Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court. But I think a collateral consequence of the development of state SG's offices is actually that the state AGs come to rely upon their SGs for all sorts of litigation advice, even beyond just, hey, what do we have up at the U.S. Supreme Court? So I think the advent or the creation or the growth of state SGs may very well have been what's caused this additional state plaintiffs litigation. So that brings me to the experience that the Department of Justice has faced with state plaintiffs litigation in the Trump administration. And I'll give you some statistics just to put this into context. In the first 2 years of the Trump administration, there were more state plaintiff lawsuits against the Trump administration and the Department of Justice than in the entire 8 years of either the Obama administration or the George W. Bush administration. To put that in further context, there have been, in the first 2 years of the Trump administration, more state plaintiffs' lawsuits against the administration than in President Reagan, H.W. Bush, and the Clinton administrations combined. In the first year alone, the Trump administration was sued 35 times by state plaintiffs. And to put that into context, that's about the total amount of state plaintiff lawsuits that the Obama administration saw in its second term in full. Now, this, of course, and would love to hear from some of my co-panelists about this, I would think not only would it divert resources, but these are going to be higher profile cases. These are going to be challenging federal policies that are probably of paramount importance to the presidential administration. And so the more lawsuits that are raised by state plaintiffs challenging these big federal programs, it only heightens, I think, the policy stakes. Now, again, I'm not sure that this is necessarily the system that our founders would have envisioned, that a bunch of state AGs sue the presidential administration when they're of opposing parties. But this seems to be possibly a new normal. And if this is a new normal, I think the Supreme Court is very quickly going to have to clarify, when do you get nationwide injunctions? Nationwide injunctions have been a recent, more heavily debated issue. And from at least the Texas perspective, you know, we were very careful about when to ask for a nationwide injunction when we were bringing lawsuits challenging the Obama administration's policies. Of course, we obtained a nationwide injunction in the DAPA deferred action litigation, but there we were also careful to say the reason that a nationwide injunction was proper in that context was because you can't have an immigration system where someone is lawfully present in one state but not another. You need a uniform immigration system throughout the entire nation. But the DAPA case was not the first time that this nationwide injunction issue had come up. And I know some of my co-panelists can talk to this. The nationwide injunction issue was raised prominently at an earlier phase of the NFIB versus Sebelius Affordable Care Act litigation. But the DAPA case, I think, because it was challenging a major Obama-era program and we obtained a nationwide injunction, I think that put on the map the idea that you could go to federal court and at least in some cases, you could block a federal policy across the country. But now, and we saw this at the tail end of my time as Texas Solicitor General at the beginning of the Trump administration, courts are now citing that DAPA case for the proposition that anytime a state challenges a federal agency action and invalidates it and obtains an injunction, that that injunction should be nationwide. Well, first of all, that's not what the Fifth Circuit's DAPA decision said. And there are reasonable arguments, I think, on both sides of this issue. You know, on one hand, injunctions should not be overbroad. Typically, you're only supposed to get relief that remedies your own injury. Now, at the same time, the Administrative Procedure Act says that courts should, quote, set aside, unquote, unlawful agency actions. Well, maybe this is an exception where if you're challenging a federal administrative action under the Administrative Procedure Act, maybe Congress has spoken and said that agency action should be set aside in full. There are good arguments on both sides of that issue, and there's a lot of economic commentary on it right now. I think the Supreme Court's going to have to take a case pretty soon to clarify that. What I would say is the rule is going to be uniform going forward, I would hope, and the rule for challenging policies of a Republican administration will then also and should also be the same rule challenging policies of the Democratic administration that could potentially come in the future. So that's to say, I think when it comes to nationwide injunctions, the debate is either between do you set them aside under the APA in full or do you do a more nuanced test that looks at the traditional test of is this broad enough to grant full relief to the plaintiffs but tailored enough to go no further? And I know the courts right now are debating where exactly that line should be drawn, and I'd love to hear from my co-panelists some more on the nationwide injunction issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Keller. Mr. Eggleston.
Thank you. I'm Neil Eggleston. I think when he was referring to co-panelists, he was actually referring to me, since I was White House counsel, in fact, for many of the cases that he discussed, and so let me just get right to them. So, this is an example, I think, of one of these principles that happens in law all the time, which is sometimes it's not the principle, it's whether you won or lost. I definitely agree that the aspect of states suing the federal government, it didn't start in the Obama administration, but it certainly sped up in the administration. It has been that increase in speed has certainly increased in the Trump administration. I'm not sure if you look at all the cases whether statistics actually tell much of a story. I think you probably have to look at what the individual cases are about in order to determine whether the statistics are actually meaningful if you just go through number of cases. But we had a whole series of cases on issues that mattered enormously to President Obama, which were stopped by litigation by the states. I'm going to mostly talk about DAPA and then another case, but we had the Clean Power Plan that was stopped. The president cared enormously about the Clean Power Plan that was stopped through litigation, and various other labor, environmental, and other issues that the president personally cared a lot about that were stopped by litigation brought by the states. But let me spend a minute on the DAPA case, because I agree with my co-panelist that in some ways I do think it became the model for what happened subsequently. I frankly think that the Fifth Circuit was pretty uncareful in its reasoning, and sometimes judges forget there might be a change in administrations, and reasoning that looks good on one side may not look so good to you if you're going to end up on the other side. There are a few things I think that happened just to remind everybody, this was the president's program to provide deferred action for a period of 2 or 3 years to parents of American citizens or lawful and permanent residence holders. People forget what the program was actually about, but that's what the program was about. Texas sued. Texas claimed standing because of an impact on its subsidized driver's licenses. I thought that wasn't sufficient, frankly, and various judges along the way, including 4-4, I think. We don't know why the Supreme Court ultimately didn't choose to review that case when it got it, but the vote was 4-4. I think probably 4-4 on the standing issue, although that's just a guess by me. I was troubled at the time, frankly, because this is one of these cases where a bunch of states, I think we were about evenly divided, about 20 states came in on behalf of striking down the program, and about 20 states came in on the other side. And the states that came in on the other side put forth evidence saying, no, we think this program will be an economic benefit for us. These people will pay taxes. They will be participants in our society. We think it'll be a law enforcement benefit because these people will be able to come out of the shadows and assist law enforcement and not worry about, if they do so, being grabbed by ICE and deported. And so there were sort of tensions on both sides, but one aspect of this, and I was quite sensitive of this at the time, is that as a result of the nationwide injunction, the states that wanted it were deprived of it because the states that didn't want it, didn't want it. And the Fifth Circuit didn't really address that except to say There's no offsetting of costs, and even if Texas would have benefited economically, as I remember, the court said there's no, that for standing analysis, you essentially don't offset costs. There were a few peculiar issues about that, I think, or a little that case. I think my colleague would have to acknowledge the red states have a better ability to place cases with actual specific judges than the blue states did. Certainly, that's what happened in the DAPA case. Let me just talk for a second about Massachusetts v. EPA. I do think this may be a little bit of an example. I think the citation by the Fifth Circuit to Massachusetts v. EPA is probably actually incorrect. I think the case had more to do with a statutory analysis than a standalone special solicitude. But again, if you're going to unleash that dog, the dog may come back to bite you, and I think that's something that the Fifth Circuit has seen in that particular case. So I acknowledge that this trend has certainly increased during the Trump administration, but as I say, I think that I felt it pretty intensely during the Obama administration as well. Before I get to the other nationwide injunction case, I'm going to deviate just for a second and talk about a recent study that's in the NYU, I don't think the law review, I think it's on a NYU study group, that I think is interesting with regard to lawyering by the executive branch. So they've done a study that in the rollback of regulation cases, let me just say, I'm not warranting the study. I haven't gone in to see if it's accurate or not accurate. It's public in the sense if people have disagreed with it, they have the ability to write in. But on the rollback of regulation cases, the analysis they've done is that the Trump administration has lost 39 of those cases and won 2 of those cases. So I teach at Harvard Law School part-time as well, and periodically one of the things I talk about with the students is sort of the quality of executive branch lawyering. And you kind of think to yourself, how could that possibly have happened? Typically in these kinds of cases, the win rate by the administration is in the 75% level. I think what ultimately ended up happening, I think most of these cases turn out to be cases where the administration sought to delay the implementation date of regulations that had already gone into effect and had an implementation date. And the law is pretty clear, and I think that if you looked at who the judges are, you'd find there are some, many appointed by Democratic presidents and many appointed by Republican presidents, and it's because the law is quite clear that if you're going to undo a regulation, you have to do it by a regulation. You can't just do it by announcing. The administration does not have the power simply to amend a regulation that was promulgated by a regulation, and sometimes I kind of wonder where the executive branch lawyers have been as that process has been going forth. So just on the nationwide injunction point, because I want to give you an example going back the other way, actually also brought by Texas. And look, I get this. There's the pain of the loss, and then when the loss is also comes with a nationwide injunction, that feels like an even worse loss. And I basically felt that sort of several times when I was White House counsel. And but let me just talk about the case that I think, and I'm sure my colleague will explain to me why I'm wrong, but I think is probably the worst example of the entry of a nationwide injunction, and arises out of the transgender bathroom situation. It was a case brought in front of Judge O'Connor in Wichita Falls, Texas, and I'm not going to talk about the merits. I think the merits on all these cases are kind of hard. I'll just say I don't think I'm making news, but I actually did not think the administration, I did not actually think the Department of Education should have come out with guidance on how it was going to enforce this area. I thought it made a target, and it should just go off and do what it was going to do and not sort of create a document that would give an opportunity for somebody to sue, because ultimately, you know, your enforcement priorities and who you're going to go against isn't actually doing anything yet. It's just announcing sort of what your enforcement priorities were. I actually thought that was a mistake, and the Department of Education should just bring their cases or not and either win them in court or lose them in court. And by giving entities like Texas the opportunity to attack a policy, I thought that was a mistake, and I thought it was a mistake at the time. But what happened is a number of states and school districts brought an action before Judge Connor who's the same district judge who decided the ACA case, which that's getting so much attention over the last several weeks. And they sought to enjoin the application of the policy. And what Judge O'Connor did, so he has individual states. Frankly, I don't understand why states other than Texas are suing in Texas about a Department of Education policy. I'm pretty sure they all have their own federal courts. I don't know why school districts outside of Texas are suing in front of Judge O'Connor. They all have their own federal courts, but they all decided to get together and bring this action in front of Judge O'Connor. So what he did is he found that this policy was a violation of Title VII and enjoined the Department of Education nationwide injunction against the Department of Education from implementing its policy anywhere in the country. Now, to me, if there was ever a case, first, it's not APA action, but if there's ever a case where he could have given remedy to the parties in front of him, mind you, I think there were parties in front of him who didn't belong in front of him, but he certainly could have given remedy to all the parties in front of him without a nationwide injunction, and I think it was quite inappropriate. And just an example, he entered the injunction which included the Fourth Circuit. And as our colleague has just said, at the time, the Fourth Circuit, relying on that guidance, had affirmed the application, and it affirmed the Gloucester case. It was before the circumstances. And so what he ultimately did, a district judge in Wichita Falls, Kansas, enjoined the application of policy guidance that judges in the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals had determined were completely appropriate. Now, I don't remember anybody from a red state complaining that that was an inappropriate use of nationwide injunction. And as we go forward, I think we just have to think through sort of whether this is a principled position or whether you take the position that you like it or don't like it, depending on whether or not you had the injunction entered against you. I might say, and I think I'm right on this, although people may disagree with me on this, I have seen, partially because I teach this class and so I keep up on all the latest cases, I've seen a number of courts in some of these cases, Court of Appeals, pay more attention to the scope of the injunction and have been limiting the nationwide injunctions by some of the district courts, and I think that's probably, I think to the extent that this discussion has focused some attention on just what the scope should be, I think that's quite appropriate. And I think that we'll continue to see some activity. Just a final comment, and one part of the comment is against my interest. I think probably in cases like DAPA, like the travel ban case, I think it probably would not make any sense to have anything other than a nationwide injunction. If you think about the travel ban case, you could hardly say it's okay for people to come into California but not come into Texas. That would be a policy that just didn't really work, and probably the same on DAPA. So I think on those kinds of issues, I think it probably works, but I think that the courts have to be a lot more careful as they go forward. So I think it will definitely continue to see some more development on that. I don't know that we need the Supreme Court yet. I think the courts of appeals are starting to focus on this issue themselves. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Eggleston. Mr. Clement.
Thank you, Jesse. It's great to be here. I'm happy to be here. I didn't come here to disagree with my law partner, so I'm not going to do that. I am going to try to sort of frame up a couple of issues at a high level, just to maybe give people something to think about, and then talk about a couple of the issues and give you a few of my own thoughts on them. But you know, I think in sort of watching separation of powers issues play out in Washington, D.C. over the couple of decades I've been here, There's really two ways things can go. I mean, one observation I would make is, I think it's really hard for the political branches in particular to figure out sort of whether they're really, what they really think of a separation of powers issue until both parties' oxens have been gored. You know, it's all really fun to see the other side get kind of hunted down by an independent counsel who's responsible to no one. But then when the independent counsel statute gets turned on your administration, you start to see the wisdom of Justice Scalia's dissent in Morrison v. Olson a lot more clearly. And I think that the independent counsel statute is really a nice example of how sometimes after both parties' oxen are gored,
you can actually get to the right result from a separation of power standpoint and have the independent counsel statute lapse. But of course, there's a contrary tendency when both parties' oxen have been gored, and that is that you have a race to the bottom or a race to the top, depending on your perspective, but each succeeding party just kind of takes a phenomenon that proved somewhat useful to the last party and, you know, take it, you know, in the immortal words, a spinal tap to 11. And, you know, I think there, with respect to a couple of the issues we've touched on, including nationwide injunctions and sort of questions of duty to defend acts of Congress, I think we're a little bit at an inflection point, and it could go either way. We could either go towards, okay, that wasn't fun for us either, so let's get to a sensible result, or we could get to the point where, all right, if you're going to do that, we're going to do that plus 12. And we'll see what happens on these issues. But, you know, let me start with nationwide injunctions and give you some thoughts on that. I mean, shockingly, this is a phenomenon that goes all the way back to, the Bush 43 administration. And what I would say is, you know, when we started to see nationwide injunctions, when I was in the Solicitor General's office, we didn't think much of them. Part of that was from the standpoint of the SG's office. When you're defending the federal government, you tend to be the subject of the nationwide injunction. You don't get, as Scott did, the pleasure of going out and getting one. And to be clear, as long as courts are handing them out, I mean, you know, states and others should be out there seeking them. Well, I mean, why not? But that does raise the question of whether courts really should be handing out these nationwide injunctions. And I think there's a special problem with nationwide injunctions. That I saw back in the day in the SG's office, but I think you're really seeing it in what's going on between the current Solicitor General's office and the court. And one of the problems with nationwide injunctions is they really put a lot of pressure on the Supreme Court. Because the way the system's supposed to work is that district courts are supposed to decide certain things, courts of appeals regionally are supposed to either affirm or reverse, and then once you get to the point where the circuits are split, then the Supreme Court weighs in on an important and potentially divisive issue. But the problem with the nationwide injunctions is you have, you know, one district court judge and, you know, pick your administration. Could be Texas, could be Berkeley, depending on the administration. But you have one district court judge in one not terribly representative district who's enjoining the policy nationwide, and I think from the Supreme Court's perspective at least, that's supposed to be the Supreme Court's job, to decide as a uniform nationwide policy whether some important government policy is unconstitutional or not. And so when a district court judge sort of takes it upon himself or herself to enjoin the policy nationwide, it certainly makes sense for the Solicitor General to go to the Supreme Court and get some kind of interim relief. The Solicitor General has had to do that on a number of occasions, either before or after the circuit court has declined to do anything about the nationwide injunction. But it puts a lot of pressure on the system. The Supreme Court's being asked to weigh in on cases before there's really been any serious development in the case, let alone the kind of mature deliberation you get when one circuit has gone one way and another circuit has gone another way. So, I do think this is an issue that's going to be sort of squarely addressed by the Supreme Court in the next couple of years. And I'd venture a guess, and maybe it's a hopeful guess, but I do think that the Supreme Court is going to put some serious limits on this practice of issuing nationwide injunctions. Maybe there'll be exceptions for certain things like immigration policies, as Neil and Scott both alluded to, though frankly, I think the system actually could operate in a way in which, you know, the district court basically has territorial jurisdiction over the district and can enjoin the government's policy in the district, but nowhere else. That's kind of an antiquated notion of district court jurisdiction, but I kind of like it. But we'll see what the Supreme Court ultimately does in these cases. But I do think that's something where maybe with both parties' ox being gored and with a lot of help from the Supreme Court, who may feel like its own job is being made more difficult, that this is something where we'll get to what, at least in my view, would be a better solution. The second thing that I'll talk about where maybe I'm a little less optimistic is the duty to defend acts of Congress that you don't very much like as an administration, as a policy matter. And, you know, this sort of directly affected my life in the context of the last administration's decision not to defend the Defense of Marriage Act. But, you know, you now are seeing another manifestation of it with respect to the Justice Department's decisions to really not defend, the Affordable Care Act. I think, as, you know, my litigation past shows, I'm not a super fan of the Affordable Care Act as a policy matter or as a federalism matter, but I think there's an argument to be made that in both of those cases, the Justice Department should have stayed with its traditional policy of defending acts of Congress, even though they're quite unpopular politically with the administration that's in place at that point. And I think that there are costs to the system if the Justice Department doesn't engage in and doesn't kind of uphold its traditional duty to defend. And I do worry that this is something where I think we could get into a race to the bottom or the top. I mean, and I think, you know, this is an issue where you can make a coherent theoretical argument that the duty to defend is overrated and the executive branch should just only defend statutes that they like as a policy matter. Or that they think are constitutional just as a straight up 50-50 matter. But that hasn't been the policy of the Justice Department for essentially ever. The tradition has been that in cases that don't implicate executive power, you make an argument if there is a good faith argument to be made in defense of the statute. I think that policy, if you think about it long and hard, is the right policy from a separation of powers standpoint, because I do think that the responsibility to defend acts of Congress when they're challenged as unconstitutional is part and parcel of the executive authority vested in the president in Article 2, and it's not part and parcel of the authority vested in Congress in Article 1 or the state AGs, who are happy to jump in and defend as well in the case of the ongoing litigation over the ACA. And I guess the last thing I'll sort of say about just on that point is one of the more memorable lines from one of my clients, in the DOMA litigation was one of Speaker Boehner's staffers when I was talking to her about the litigation in DOMA. You know, she told me, look, I'm built for legislation. I'm not built for litigation. And I think that was basically right. And the Justice Department, by contrast, is built for litigation. So I do think that, you know, it would be a shame if we get into kind of a continuing process of administrations defending less and less of the statutes that are challenged as unconstitutional. The last thing I want to say is just about this question about changes in policy, changes of legal position across administrations. You know, I don't remember, Gene, all the details of the Hosanna-Tabor case, but I seem to think that at least I would draw a distinction between what I remember about that case, which is at the time that the SG got involved in that case, I thought the EEOC had already sort of made its enforcement position pretty clear. And maybe I'm misremembering that, but just as a general matter, to me, you know, there's a big difference between the SG going into the Supreme Court on what may look like a suicide mission to defend a policy that has been formally taken by an agency. And it's a lousy policy and it's hard to defend, but by the point that it gets to the Supreme Court and that it's clearly been the executive branch's policy, I think it's kind of a mistake to blame the Justice Department or the Solicitor General's Department. And that really comes back to the question of, you know, when you have a transition between administration and administration, there is going to be a, you know, appropriate change in some policies. But I do think, you know, and I'm not suggesting that either the current administration or the last administration didn't adhere to this, but there is sort of a right way and a wrong way to change position. I mean, the right way to change position is to get the relatively political accountable agency that's responsible for a particular policy area to change their position, to formally withdraw the regulation, to promulgate a new regulation, to change the guidance, whatever it is. But then there's a wrong way to do it, which is to sort of keep the guidance in place and just have the Justice Department sort of flip its litigation position. And, you know, when I was in the SG's office from time to time, somebody would be, you know, coming into the office and complaining about some government rule and urging us not to defend some government rule. And I always thought the appropriate thing was to, you know, depending on the agency, scribble down an address and hand it to the person complaining about the rule and tell them, look, here's, you know, the Department of X, run down there. If you can get them to withdraw the regulation, I would be delighted because I got enough other things to do. But the right way to change a position is not to have the Justice Department not defend some on-the-books promulgated regulation that's been applied by one of the other agencies when the issue is more in their expertise and, frankly, in the cosmic scheme of things, I think, you know, that department is more politically accountable for the policies in its bailiwicks than the Justice Department would be politically accountable for those policies.
Thank you. All right, let me first, is this microphone working? Okay, good. So thank you all, a lot to unpack there. We have about 15 minutes left, so let's do this. If for those who want to ask questions, please line up at the mics. I'm going to just start it off with one or two questions for our panel here, and then we'll turn to the microphone. So let me just do this. One question for each table, actually. So Mr. Scher, Mr. Keller, you have been plaintiffs against the federal government for a long time. And so what I want to ask you is, how did you deal with changes in administration? Were you ever surprised when you were dealing with a piece of litigation that straddled two administrations that you didn't get what you thought you would get in the change of administration? And then the question I'll pose here for after that is to both of you, having been in government in the last decade, how did you deal with requests to change positions? And how about your views on, as opposed to, you know, what I alluded to at the beginning, sort of just a straight legal judgment of the Department of Justice versus what you were alluding to, Paul, the change in regulatory position, how did you deal with those? So I'll kick it over to that table first, and then we'll take that question here.
Okay. Well, I actually haven't seen a situation in my own personal practice where I was surprised by a decision that a succeeding administration made. But if I could just let me take a minute to pick up on the point that Paul made about the Hosanna-Tabor case. And I agree with Paul that the SG's office was doing the right thing in defending the EEOC's policy. The point I was trying to make is about the way they went about defending it. They took an extreme and indefensible, I think, position in defending that policy. And I think they actually could have gotten a couple of votes from the court in that case if they had not taken such an extreme, what I've called a pamphleteering position. And so that's
Texas had a series of lawsuits against Obama-era policies. The Trump administration came in, and these lawsuits are hanging out there. And yeah, some of these lawsuits remain pending today. I think in many of those lawsuits, you didn't know exactly what was going to happen. You know, you needed political appointees to be able to be put into the DOJ positions to make the decisions. And then the decisions were, okay, was DOJ going to stay the course? Was DOJ going to change position? If DOJ was going to change position, what was the new position going to be? And so that's all to say, yeah, you know, from the outside, even when a new administration comes in, you know, this is the federal government. Trying to turn the Titanic, even when you want to turn the Titanic, takes a lot of time, and I think it takes a lot of resources.
Okay. And just to this table, you both probably had to deal with, as you said, Paul, requests to change positions that might have comported with policy preferences in the administration. How did you generally approach that issue as, you know, lawyers for the administration and for the government?
So I'll go first and somewhat quickly, because I was there for the last 3 years and I was largely defending our policies. And so by that time, to the extent we were going to make changes in policy, it had largely happened, so I didn't have that too much. But I have sort of just a couple of comments that are related. I'd like to tell a quick story. Don Verrilli, and I don't know how many people other than Paul here are going to know this case, but talks about the Solicitor General defending U.S. v. Bond. And Bond was that crazy case where the wife put some sort of chemical agent on the doorknob of the girlfriend intending to hurt her. and the wife is in debt. I may have the parties confused, but it doesn't matter for this purpose. So whoever did it was indicted for chemical weapons charge. And so Don talks about, and he's the Solicitor General at the time this happens, and he talks about, now what do I do because of the duty to defend? And he decided this is not a case he would have been involved in earlier. It was indicted by the district court. It was affirmed, I think, by the Third Circuit. And so he's in the Court of Appeal, I mean, in the Supreme Court, and he has to decide, what am I going to do? And he decided, look, I have a duty to defend this, and my goal, and I'm going to lose badly. And so his entire goal was to try to figure out how to lose not so badly. And I think he actually, to him, thought the case was kind of a success because he didn't lose badly. He sort of lost on the statutory issue, which was a dead loser. There's some sort of interesting treaty power cases that the dissent brought up, to some of the dissents brought up, but that's been. But then the second piece I just want to mention is that, and I'm going to do this a little light because I've never really talked about my communications with my successor, Don McGahn. But there's one case I said to him, look, you know, which is the Fast and Furious privilege litigation. I said, look, this is Eric Holder being sued, Eric gone by then. By then it was Loretta Lynch being sued by the House over producing these Fast and Furious documents. And your friends at they're now Republican in the House, are going to come to you and say that you should roll over on this case. And I said, look, you know, you got to remember the Obama administration started with a Democratic House and a Democratic Senate and ended up with a Republican House and a Republican Senate. So you got to remember, you know, precedents like this matter to this administration. I've worked for two presidents and I care about this stuff. And I said, Don, don't roll over on this. You're going to want this. So I've sort of lost track of what have happened. But they're going to want this today and for a lot of days, because it turned out to be a very powerful opinion. The court ended up on kind of a waiver theory requiring the Justice Department to turn over the documents, none of which I cared remotely about, frankly. But the principle of executive privilege applying to that kind of material was strongly upheld by the district court. And I said, Don, look, you know, life can change here and look a little bit ahead. And so, in some sense, the reverse of that happened with me.
So just a quick few comments. I mean, I was actually the opposing lawyer for Ms. Bond in the Bond case. So I know a little bit about this case. And I think Neil's exactly right that the SG's office did the right thing in the end by defending the position that was taken by the U.S. attorney. But I will say the fact that Don can spin a case that went to the Supreme Court twice and the government lost both times 9-0. The fact that Don can spin that as a limited success, I think is a testament to lawyering and lawyers. The second thing I'll say is, you know, we had a very similar situation to what Neil describes at the beginning of the Bush administration, where Representative Burton was still looking for some documents that had to do with one of the last scandals of the Clinton administration. I've now forgotten what the scandal was, but you know, we recognized then that was a great opportunity at a transition time to continue to defend the position of the executive branch that the documents were privileged, because if you get a second term, what that means is that you're going to spend about 75% of your 8 years in power in defending your own messes, where any assertion of executive privilege is going to look entirely self-serving and just read today's newspapers, sort of precipitate claims of a cover-up. It's only at the very beginning of an administration that you can actually take like the principled position of defending the executive's position in the context of defending somebody else's mess. And so there are some kind of unique opportunities at the beginning of an administration to not change position, but to keep a position that is in the long-term interest of the executive branch and really argue it in a way that can, in a weird way, can be stronger than the previous administration making the same arguments.
Thank you all. All right, we have about 5 minutes because the lunch panel starts right after this one. So I just ask panelists if you can, questioners, keep your questions succinct, and we'll be able to get to some answers. So why don't we start over here?
James Young, National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation. I was actually in the court when they announced Hosanna Tabor were about to argue my second case. It's good karma, since it was my denomination, I ended up winning. But my question, I guess, would address, won't convert this into an ethics credit for CLE folks, but I'd like you to, the generals on the panel, to address the ethics in the marriage cases, we had the spectacle of attorneys general in Pennsylvania and California refusing to defend the duly enacted statutes of those states. In Virginia, the spectacle was even worse, where we had an attorney general, a newly elected attorney general, who actually switched sides. Could you address the ethical considerations, if any, or do you feel comfortable addressing those?
Scott, do you want to start with that from a state perspective, and then?
I guess I'd just echo a lot of what Paul had to say. I mean, the duty to defend, whether you're talking about as the United States Attorney General or a state attorney general, how that is going to play out is going to answer those questions. And, you know, do you want a system where you have to defend everything, period? Well, there are going to be some things that maybe are way over the line that you'd say, well, that's just blatantly unconstitutional. Why should you defend that? The problem is, as soon as you start to draw the line anywhere else, you know, that this is where this leads. I know Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton thought there was a difference between a legislature passing a statute and an agency taking an action, and maybe there was a hard and fast duty to defend statutes that maybe if it was an agency action that could be different. But of course, that is one person's view on the topic, and I think reasonable people can disagree about this.
Yeah, and I think there are some ethical issues, but I do think there are probably more kind of interesting separation of powers issues than purely ethical issues, because presumably the reason there's not a square ethical problem is you have a conception of who your client is that allows you to say that not defending it is actually sort of following your client's advice in some respects. I mean, I will say, one of the things, and I think they're and this was a deliberate choice that is backed up by a Walter Dellinger OLC opinion, but I think one of the strangest things about the administration's position as to DOMA was at the same moment they were deciding that they weren't going to defend the act in Congress, they continued to execute the act. So they, and that, to me seems just about 100% backwards, which is it seems to me that the executive does have the ability to independently say, oh, this is an unconstitutional statute, and we're not going to take executive action that we think violates the Constitution. So we actually won't, for example, deport somebody who could stay in the country if we thought that their same-sex marriage was recognized. But the administration was taking the position, and again, they were doing it deliberately, and they were backed by an OLC opinion, just one I happen to think is kind of backwards, that says that it's okay to implement a statute you think is unconstitutional, but at the same time not defend it in court. And I do think that's backwards.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Sir? Okay. My question's about political accountability and what that looks like. And I don't mean a tsunami like Trump, but when you've got agencies that will drag it out so long, in my case with the FTC, they argued in front of the 10th Circuit after 6 years that they can adjudicate during a case. They can make new rules during adjudication due to Chenery and Bell Atlantic. I mean, and they throw this out in the bottom of the ninth, and that's a 9-year, game. How can you hold that politically accountable? By this time, no one's paying attention.
Thank you. We'll take short answers to that, and then I'm going to have to dismiss the group for lunch. So who wants to take that?
Well, it's not a great answer, but I will say part of the reason you have all the state plaintiff lawsuits against federal agency policies is because they're federal agency actions. It's not Congress passing laws, and if Congress were passing laws and setting the policies, there wouldn't be this ability to go into court to override them. So it's not an answer to your question, but I mean, it's acknowledging the problem.
Yeah, and the only thing I would say is, and I share your frustration, I'm dealing with a comparable situation right now, but the question on all these things is politically accountable compared to what?
Yeah.
And, if the alternatives are further empowering the Article III judiciary or further empowering Justice Department people who are supposed to be in their positions not because they know anything about FTC policy, but because they're good litigators, I still think it's a lousy set of choices, but I still think of the three, having the FTC do it and own it is the most politically accountable.
I agree. I just don't know how that happens. So we got to figure out how that happens. Thanks.
Well, please join me in thanking this very distinguished panel for their excellent comments. Thank you all very much. Thank you.